World News Today, brought to you by the Admiral Corporation in behalf of distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
There's a possibility that Cherbourg has fallen. Nothing official yet from Allied quarters, but Berlin concedes that the big port probably is now in our hands. The news agency DNB says the German garrison fought to the last bullet, but we repeat, that's not confirmed so far. Our invasion troops have gotten heavy support from the big bombers today, about 1,500 of them. In Russia, the Germans admit that Red Army forces have made new breaches in the Vitebsk area, and the Russian offensive has spread all the way to the gates of Mogilev on the upper Dnieper. In Italy, the Americans have taken Falonica and are now within 40 miles of Livorno. On Pacific war fronts, American carrier planes have destroyed 72 more Jap aircraft and 5 enemy ships in bold new sweeps protecting our invasion troops on Saipan Island. And MacArthur headquarters reports the destruction or damaging of another 22 Jap planes caught on the ground at Yap Island, southwest of the Marianas. Now for more news from Normandy, Admiral takes you to the invasion bridgehead in France, Bill Downs reporting.
British troops are advancing southeast to the town of Tilly today and already have gained some 2.5 to 3 miles. This fighting breaks the pause which has held in the British-Canadian sector for the past 10 days. Today's advance pushes another bulge out of the big beachhead line at a point some 8 miles west of Caen. The ground gained today represents only a local advance. But any advance on this sector can only spell more trouble for the Germans. Prisoners and knocked-out enemy equipment are still being counted, but at least 9 enemy tanks are believed to have been destroyed. Today is the first real summer day that we have had here in Normandy. Down on the Tilly front where I was this morning, the men were sweating and grinning. It was the first time that the sun has warmed the beachhead, and the men liked it. Sunshine has that effect on morale. Throughout the countryside, many men took their first baths in 3 weeks. It was the first time that it's been warm enough. In the rear areas, in the villages, it was more of a day for picnics than for war. A game of scrub baseball was organized in one field, and men not on duty lolled under the trees. To further contrast the front-line conditions, the village churches found occasion to ring their bells. Sunday starts very early in the Catholic Normandy province, and since dawn, the countryside has been noisy with the music of the church belfries. And the whole of the civilian population of liberated France went for a walk this afternoon. Shoes were shined and clothing brushed, and little boys looked very uncomfortable in their boots. As a matter of fact, their shoes are really uncomfortable. 90% of them have wooden soles. But the brightest objects in all of free France today was not the sun or the scrubbed faces of the children. It was the best Sunday hats of the ladies. I have a narrow masculine opinion of the things that women put on their heads and call headgear. And the French women here, like the girls back home, can do some mighty strange things with a few feathers or flowers or straw. I was standing near a soldier watching this Sunday parade of women's hats on the way to a village church. "Look at them," the soldier said, pointing to the latest Normandy hat fashion.
"Aren't they terrible?"
"But it's sure good to see them, just like home."
And this is Bill Downs in Normandy, returning you to the United States.
And now for a supplementary report on the fighting in France, Admiral takes you back across the Atlantic to London, Charles Shaw reporting.
The German official news agency has announced the American capture of Cherbourg, although we haven't claimed it yet. The German agency, according to a broadcast heard in London, said the German garrison was forced to yield because of the shortage of ammunition. Now, this is about some of the men whose participation in the liberation of Europe has been interrupted, about others whose resistance against our offensive is definitely at an end. It's about American wounded and enemy prisoners. And first, about the wounded. These wounded men are of all types, of all ranks, and of all outfits. They're paratroopers, tank drivers, infantrymen, glider-borne soldiers, enlisted men, and officers. The best description I can give you of the hospital where they are is the remark made by a wounded American when he arrived there. "Gee," he said, "they've brought us to a country club." And this hospital, and there are others like it here in England, is a rambling open establishment built along Spanish patio-like lines. In every building, you see unobtrusive signs warning you
that health is promoted by cleanliness, and cleanliness is indeed the cardinal principle.
If you carelessly throw a cigarette butt into a courtyard, you're politely reminded that there are receptacles at convenient intervals. Boys with brooms brush away steadily. These patients aren't typical army because they don't gripe about the chow. And after eating a few meals with them, I can understand why there are few, if any, complaints. The general chow for lunch yesterday had good old American frankfurters
as the entree. But for those who need lighter fare, there are such things as boiled or scrambled eggs,
real eggs, not powdered,
custards, toast, and tea, or real thick milk for those who wanted it.
A report on what these wounded really talk about might sound like propaganda stuff or morale-building stuff. To be a good reporter, you're supposed to be suspicious. So when you hear one or two fellows acting and talking cheerfully, you naturally question a lot more to get the true picture. But the true picture, as I saw it drawn at this hospital, is that the main complaint the patients have is that they were hauled out of action so soon after it began. They want to get back, and most of them have a good chance of realizing their ambition. And during the weekend, I saw others who have been dragged summarily from the field of battle who won't go back until the fighting's all over. They're the Germans who have been brought here as prisoners. If you want to, I guess you can read all sorts of things into the manners and expressions of those prisoners. Arrogance, meekness, boldness, humility. The ones I saw were a group of young and rather old men, dazed from battle and dazed perhaps from the realization that Goebbels was wrong when he said England had been leveled by the Nazi assortment of flying weapons.
That was Charles Shaw in London. We'll have more news in just a moment, but first, Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Do you know what would happen if you broke an egg on a plate and left it uncovered in your refrigerator for a couple of weeks? We can tell you that it would practically disappear, leaving only a yellow spot on the plate. This happens because the conventional type cooling unit draws all the moisture from foods and wraps it around the coils. But an egg broken and left uncovered for a similar length of time in the After Victory Admiral 2 temperature refrigerator will retain all its moisture and goodness. Much of the frost on the coils of your refrigerator, which you must remove by defrosting at regular intervals, is moisture that has been drawn from the food you placed there. But all this moisture sapping will end when peacetime production permits the manufacture of the Admiral 2 temperature refrigerator. For Admiral will present the first major advancement in home refrigeration in many years. The moist cold of the Admiral will keep foods just as fresh and nourishing as they were when you put them in the refrigerator without the use of covered dishes. And the messy job of defrosting will end because in the new Admiral, there will be nothing to defrost. We know that you and all America will approve the Admiral 2 temperature refrigerator just as all America has approved Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
The Red Army's swiftly developing summer offensive has spread to sectors 450 miles southward from the Finnish Karelian Isthmus today all the way to the gates of strategic Mogilev on the upper Dnieper, the very core of Hitler's strongest defense system on the Russian front. Moscow dispatches say new and greater surprises are believed to be in store for the dazed German high command, already staggering from a sanguinary war of attrition. The German commentator, Ernst von Hammer, said the Russians had achieved a breakthrough in the Bobruisk area. Bobruisk is 70 miles southwest of Mogilev, and forced the German lines back several miles. Masses of tanks and fighter bombers on a scale never seen before during the entire Russian campaign were thrown into the attack, he said. Another breakthrough was made on the Smolensk-Orsha road. The Berlin radio said at least 80 Soviet infantry divisions and a tank army had launched a great general attack from Bobruisk to Vitebsk, and the German communique admitted that breaches in the central front had been widened. Encirclement of Vitebsk virtually is complete as two great Soviet armies close in, leaving a gap of only 22 miles for a German escape. Points of heavy tank attack and artillery strength and deep mines are being under heavy pummeling by the Russians. Already under a Russian attack. In that sector, the Russians now are only 69 miles from the Soviet Latvian Republic, 120 miles from the Lithuanian Republic, and 110 miles from Dvinsk, the biggest communication center in the Baltic area. The circle being closed around the Nazis reaches from the western Dvina and Dnieper rivers to points northwest and southeast of Vitebsk, and Russians now are pressing down on the city from the northwest can hear the guns of their comrades from the southeast. The last railway remaining from the German rear into Vitebsk was cut on Friday. The Russians say the Germans have lost more than 5,500 killed in this area up to yesterday. South of Vitebsk, the newest attacks of the Red Army appeared aimed at relieving the important White Russian municipalities of Mogilev and Orsha on the upper Dnieper. In Italy, the Allied 5th and 8th Armies are still moving ahead up the Italian peninsula. And now for a direct report on the latest developments, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
American and French troops are steadily forcing back the right wing of the German defense front in Italy. American armored units are heading up Highway 73 toward Monticello, which is only 15 miles over the hills from Siena. French Spahis are working up the narrow wooded valleys on their east, and to the west, a strong American force is fanning out beyond captured Polonica and threatening the lateral roads which lead to Piombino, the next important supply port on the Italian west coast. The war has once again hit the ancient towns of Italy. 8th Army tanks are fighting within the walls of Chiusi, which already has changed hands twice in 6 days of bitter fighting. Especially in Umbria, where all the main roads north converge on Florence, the Germans are clinging to each mountain village, shelling and mortaring the approaches, abandoning them only when we have brought up forces strong enough to mount a many-pronged attack or artillery enough to blast them out. In the open country, they have covered their widespread demolitions of bridges, culverts, buildings, and crossroads with small arms and machine gun fire, sometimes by a platoon, sometimes by a company of infantry. With limited resources, the Germans are fighting hard. It is for them a desperate, necessary, but very costly delaying action. It's estimated that they now have available in Italy the equivalent of 12 and a half divisions, which is just about half of what they had when the Allied offensive south of Rome began. Our progress has been slow during the past few days, but it's doubtful that the Germans can stop us for long south of Florence. The 15th Air Force today sent out a strong fleet of heavy bombers to blast oil installations at Cirque in southern France, railway yards at Avignon, and railway bridges across the River Rhone. As the war moves away from Rome, the Allied military government here is tackling the big problems of food, transport, and the black market. During these first 3 weeks, we have not been able to bring food supplies into the city as fast as we'd expected. But sometimes it is the most. Under the Germans, the people of Rome could buy fresh fruits and vegetables only on the black market. We have brought in limited amounts of both during the past week, and today we distributed 100 tons of vegetables, our best day so far. The job of feeding Rome has been made immensely greater by the refugees, people who came here to escape the battle zone or to avoid Allied bombing. When we arrived, we estimated there would be 500,000 refugees in the capital. We have now been told by the Vatican, which has kept a careful check, that there are a million persons in Rome who do not normally belong here. So the city's population today is close to 2.25 million. This is Winston Burdett returning you now to CBS in New York.
And out in Chicago, Republican leaders are gathering for the National Convention, which formally opens tomorrow. For a summary of late developments and an eyewitness picture of the convention scene, Admiral takes you to Chicago Stadium, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
As for convention news, there's nothing concrete to report. At this moment, the sad lights in the eyes of Bricker and Stassen backers bears eloquent testimony to the strength of Tom Dewey. It looks as though he'll get it if he will accept it. And I haven't met anybody yet who doesn't feel that Mr. Dewey can be persuaded. So that's the latest news that has seeped out of the smoke-filled rooms of this town's hotels, although it's difficult to understand how even a wisp of smoke could get into a Chicago hotel room this week. With me now is a dapper young Chicago Irishman who has turned the old rough-and-tumble job of ushering into an art and a fine, fat career for himself. His name is Andy Frain, and of course, he'll be running things out here at the stadium. Just in case you don't think ushering can be a career, I'd like Andy to tell you just a few of his jobs. Andy?
Well, Bill, we handle all the ball games, fights, and racetracks in the state of Illinois, plus everything that goes on out here at the Chicago Stadium. My ushers also work ballparks all over the country. I put in the system now used at the Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, as well as that used out in the two ballparks in Los Angeles.
And don't forget that Kentucky Derby.
I have handled the Kentucky Derby 12 times, and crowds of over 100,000 people.
Supposing, Andy, I was on my way by bus to Spokane, Washington, and had a day to kill here tomorrow. I therefore try to crash your convention hall. What would my problem be, Dr. Frayne?
If I was on my way by bus to Spokane, Washington, and had any thoughts about crashing the Democratic or Republican convention, I would stay right on that bus.
But supposing I was an honest delegate and had lost my tickets at one of those taffy polls Chicago runs all night, then what?
If you are an honest delegate and you have a right to be in the stadium, all you have to do is come to my office, and if you're okay, I'll have you in the stadium in a couple of seconds.
How large a crew will you have working starting tomorrow, Andy?
I will have exactly 250 people working tomorrow. 100 girls and 150 men.
That means that you'll have only 250 men and girls handling a crowd of more than 21,000. They must be pretty good ushers.
They are, Bill, all top people.
I know they are, Andy. I've seen them working lots of places. Now, one more thing. I don't like to go into this too deeply, but I imagine you heard what One Eye Conley said on a local station last week.
I really did. And Conley really burns me up a little bit.
Conley, as all America knows, is the world's greatest gatecrasher. He's in Chicago now for the convention, and broadcasting on a local station, he told the town and Andy Frayne that neither Frayne nor his men would ever stop the great One Eye Conley. What about that, Andy?
Bill, you could write this down in your book. And I tell you, and Conley, and a coast-to-coast audience, that One Eye, on June 26, 27, 28, 29, will not only not get into the Chicago Stadium, he won't even get on Madison Street. And if he does, I'm going to buy you a brand new suit of clothes.
Poor One Eye, I don't expect he'll ever see this convention. Unless, of course, he's nominated vice president. And the way everybody is ducking that job, he's got a good chance. Thanks, Andy Frayne. Now back to Admiral in New York.
That was Bill Slocum, Jr., reporting from Chicago Stadium on the opening of the Republican Convention. And now for an interview with the chief of the Navy's pilot training program, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington. Don Pryor reporting.
The Navy has just announced a reduction in its pilot training program, which affects thousands of young men throughout the country. At the height of the war, that's a rather startling thing for the Navy to do. So Captain Stanhope Ring, USN, the Director of Naval Aviation Training, has come here today to explain it to you.
First of all, we can reduce the pilot training program at this time because our losses of flight personnel to date have, fortunately, been considerably less than we dared hope. Our men and equipment have proved to be so superior to the Japanese that we simply don't need the large reserve of pilots that we thought would be necessary.
Well, I suppose last week's Battle of the Eastern Philippines would be a good example of that.
A perfect example. In that whole battle over the two-day period, we lost roughly 70 planes and destroyed about 375 of theirs. And even that doesn't tell the whole story. Our planes didn't reach the Japanese fleet until just before dark. But even then, they sank or severely damaged a large number of enemy ships, including several carriers. The Japs, on the other hand, were able to cause only slight damage to three of our ships, and they struck in daylight. Besides, a large percentage of our pilots who were shot down or forced to land on the water were rescued.
Well, it seems to me, then, that your decision to reduce the number of cadets in flight training is really one of the most encouraging stories of the war.
It certainly is encouraging to us. It means that we have been able to train our personnel so thoroughly and to provide them with such superior equipment that they outclass the Japanese in every respect. Naturally, we couldn't count on that when the war began. We had to guess what our losses would be, and we had to train enough men to compensate for the estimated losses. Then, too, we allowed a liberal percentage for war weariness. As you know, a winning team doesn't get weary, and we've got a winning team.
Captain, why wouldn't it be a good idea to complete the training of all the boys who have already started the program?
Perhaps it would be a good idea if it weren't for the manpower situation. Under the circumstances, I don't believe the Navy would be justified in training large numbers of pilots beyond those required. Unfortunately, there are going to be a lot of disappointments. All of us regret that sincerely.
Well, can you tell me just how the reduction is going to be made?
Standards of performance have been raised in all stages of training. Those who have started their primary flying and those in the intermediate course will be continued in training provided they can meet the raised standards. All of those in the earlier stages, whose actual flight training has not yet started, have had the situation fully explained in a personal letter from Rear Admiral A.W. Radford. About one half of this group can be continued in training. The rest must be withdrawn, but may select any one of several options which have been offered.
Well, does this action of the Navy, Captain, mean that none of these boys can remain in naval aviation?
Not at all. There is a great opportunity for these young men to serve as combat air crewmen, the fighting gunners of naval aviation. Furthermore, we will keep a careful record of the names of all of those withdrawn from the program so that they will be available for future training as pilots should the needs of the service so require.
Well, I hope the Japanese have been listening to this broadcast, Captain Ring. They would be interested, I'm sure. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
The Chinese High Command announced today that severe fighting is in progress in the outer defenses of Hengyang, the Hunan Province Railway Center, and most important city attacked by the Japanese since they took Hankou in 1938. The Japanese left wing took Pingxiang, about 100 miles northeast of Hengyang, and their right wing attacked in the vicinity of Xinjiang, 60 miles north of Hengyang, after the arrival of reinforcements. A gloomy view of the military situation prevails among both foreigners and Chinese in Chungking, who are convinced the Japanese are engaged in an all-out attempt to neutralize China as an allied base for attacks on the Japanese Empire. In Burma, Chinese troops and British Chindits have entered the Japanese base at Mogaung, and heavy fighting is in progress. The Chindits broke through the outer defense east of Mogaung and took the important railway between the station and the bridge. At the same time, Chinese troops entered the town from north and south. Meanwhile, Michinar, the main North Burma base of the Japs, 35 miles east of Mogaung, is still holding out against Allied attacks. And we repeat that American carrier planes have destroyed 72 more Japanese aircraft and five enemy ships in new sweeps on Saipan Island. And now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral.
You have a pleasant surprise in store for you when you see the smart styling and graceful beauty of the post-war line of Admiral radio phonographs. And you'll be positively amazed at the almost human operation of the newer, simpler Admiral automatic record changer. The pre-war Admiral changer was good enough, in fact, to make Admiral the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. But the new Admiral changer will offer so much more. The changing time between records will be shorter. Surface noises will be practically non-existent. There'll be less chance than ever for chipping or breaking your precious records. There'll be new depth and quality to the tone and reproduction of your favorite selections. And, of course, there'll be Slide Away. Slide Away is the exclusive Admiral feature by which your complete phonograph, turntable, and automatic record changer appear or vanish at a touch, simply by opening the cabinet doors. Yes, your new Admiral radio phonograph will live up to all your expectations in the better, brighter world of tomorrow. We all know it's vitally important that America produce the largest quantity of food this year in our history. We must provide food for ourselves, food for our fighting men and women all over the world, food for our allies, and food for the hungry populace of the liberated countries of Europe. But a portion of this great effort is lost because of the tremendous waste of food. It is estimated that 20% of all the food we raise is wasted. Let's do all we can to fight this waste of food, one of the most essential of our war weapons. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.